So the, just looking at the fourth section of the Anapanasati Sutta, and we talked a lot yesterday about the observing impermanence, breathing in, one trains oneself, I will breathe in observing impermanence. I will breathe out observing impermanence, and how we do that, not only observing impermanence in the world around us, but most especially in our practice, observing impermanence in our experience of the body and our experience of the mind and heart, the fluctuation, the changes. We talked about the impermanence of feelings and pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, how feelings, when mindfulness is absent, can give rise to craving and clinging and all kinds of unskillful speech and actions, which create more suffering for ourselves and others. And so when we really understand the impermanent nature of feelings, when we understand the impermanent nature of perceptions, it helps us to not get caught. It helps us to see those patterns and not get hooked into, you know, trying to hold on to something that, of course, we can't hold on to because of its very nature. So the sutta goes on talking about observing impermanence, and then there are four other qualities or developments that begin to unfold with a deep seeing into impermanence. And sometimes people read these words and they sound like, oh, that must be for some, you know, monastic, you know, meditating years and years in a cave, or, you know, just totally dedicating their life to practice and not doing anything else in their lives. But I really don't think that's true. I think that these are developments of the mind which we can all, that can unfold, that can develop within us when we're when we're practicing with commitment and with when we're making practice, Dharma practice, an important part of our lives, perhaps the central part of our lives. Which doesn't mean not living. Doesn't mean not living in the world. So the next, and there are different words that are sometimes used to translate the Pali, but the second development coming out of, excuse me, seeing deeply into impermanence, and I described yesterday how the three characteristics are very interconnected. So impermanence, or anicca in Pali, dukkha, the wide range of meanings that it has, from unreliability, unsatisfactoriness, suffering. So dukkha and anatta, the non-self or contingent nature of all experience. So we talked about how in seeing impermanence we see all of these. So as impermanence is directly known in our experience in meditation, the word dispassion is used in the sutta. I've often heard it translated as and as disenchantment. So both dispassion and disenchantment can sound kind of negative. You know, like we use the word enchanting, like oh, that's, you know, that was just an enchanting dance recital, or, you know, this child is so enchanting, just really lovely and delightful. But you know, when we think about some of the central myths of Western culture, of many cultures, enchantment is actually not seen as something that's so positive. You know, sometimes somebody is enchanted, like the prince or the princess is enchanted, and it means that they lose connection, that they come out of themselves, they're disconnected from themselves, they're under a spell. And so in that sense, to be disenchanted means to awaken from a spell. And that's the sense of this word, disenchanted, that when we awaken from the spell, that somehow we can find our sense of happiness, our sense of being content, fulfilled, grounded, in something that comes from outside, a sense experience, a possession, a title, a degree, a job, even a relationship, as enriching as relationships can be. You know, they are inherently unstable. And so if we're looking for a relationship to make us feel good all the time, that relationship probably won't endure, because for a relationship to endure, we need to again and again step up to the changes that are happening, you know, in the relationship, in ourselves, in the other. So that spell, that misperception or mistaken belief that we're going to live happily ever after, you know, when we find Mr. Right or Ms. Right or the right, you know, just the right job. Again, you know, when we find work that is truly, that we truly engage with and we love, it's a blessing. And it's not always going to make us feel good. You know, it's not always going to be pleasant. So that's, so waking up, when we deeply see impermanence, we wake up from the spell. We're disenchanted. We recognize that we can't hold on to anything. We can't, nor can we resist, nor can we keep pushing away things that we don't want. So, you know, however much we exercise and eat well, we will age. You know, we will get sick. Can't avoid sickness, you know, as well as we may take care of ourselves. And we will die. This body will come to an end. So to deeply, to live with a deep understanding, not just an intellectual understanding, but a seeing how we're, like, in a way, every moment when we see the arising and passing away of experience, you know, when we see every moment arises in consciousness and passes away, we're seeing dying in each moment. We're seeing loss in each moment. And a new moment is being born. And yet, when the Buddha talks about birth, he's usually pointing to birth into the world of grasping and aversion and delusion. So he usually uses birth for that, to point to that kind of continuation of the cycle of suffering. And so so this disenchantment moves, unfolds into the word that's used is cessation. So how I understand cessation is the mind stops reaching out. The mind, we deeply know as a whole being, deep in the being, there's a knowing that the reaching out to grasp, the reaching out to hold, the construction of a self is a drivenness that doesn't satisfy and that brings suffering. And when this is deeply known, we stop. We just stop. And there's a kind of a resting, an inward resting that develops, that evolves, in that the world comes to you. The world comes into consciousness, and there's a stillness. There's a stillness, an inner stillness, in which everything can be received. So gain and loss, pain and pleasure, fame and disrepute, or fame and kind of being ignored, and then having a great reputation, and and then having people speak negatively about you. All of these things happened to the Buddha. I mean, he was often, you know, really slagged by people who criticized him, and somebody spread rumors about him, and his nephew tried to kill him. So he had his share of misfortune, and you know, but there was he received it. There's a story about the Buddha, who there was this doctor, Angulimala, who he suffered something very terrible in his life, a really traumatic loss, and he got a bit really turned around, really deeply, deeply traumatized, and and he went to a teacher who was a very kind of misguided teacher, and taught, you know, dangerous practices and harmful practices, and this teacher was instructing him to kill people, and I mean, it's not so bizarre. We hear about, you know, cults you know, in our time, who where this kind of thing is taught. And I mean, it's bizarre, but it's it's not for just ancient times. And so he was going around killing people, and he went after the Buddha. He was, this teacher said, you know, kill that teacher. And when he would kill somebody, he would sever one of their fingers and make a necklace of their fingers. Yeah. And pretty awful. And that's why he was called Angulimala, because he had this mala of fingers that he wore. And so he saw the Buddha, and he began chasing him. And however fast he was running, like, he couldn't catch up with the Buddha. Like, the Buddha wasn't running, but he was always away. He was always a distance away. And Angulimala called out to the Buddha, and he said, "Stop!" You know, why would the Buddha stop? But anyway, he said, "Stop!" And his Buddha response was, and the Buddha's response to him was, "I have stopped, Angulimala. Now you stop." And so, and my understanding of that story is, like, he has come to a deep cessation. I have stopped. I have stopped running. I have stopped being driven by greed, hatred, and delusion. So that cessation, that stopping, that deep inner stopping, is not a cutting off from life, but is an opening that life will flow to us and through us. And it comes from the cessation of grasping. And another word that's sometimes used to translate cessation is quenching, the quenching of dukkha. So the quenching of this thirst for more and more. So finally, my thirst is quenched. You know. And then the fourth is relinquishment. One trains with oneself, I will breathe in observing relinquishment. So all of these in this final stanza of the four tetrads, last four tetrads, are I will breathe in observing impermanence. I will breathe in observing dispassion or disenchantment. I will breathe in observing cessation or quenching. So we're not actually doing anything. We're just allowing this unfolding to happen. It's just happening on a deep level because, you know, we're because of the deep insight into impermanence. And the last one is, I will breathe in observing relinquishment, breathe out observing relinquishment. I like the way Buddhadasa talks about this. Buddhadasa, you know, in the way he teaches from this perspective of we are nature, and we are the reason why we suffer is because we try to take from nature and hold on for ourselves, and this, you know, creates stress because it's against nature. So he describes relinquishment as throwing it all back, like throwing it all back to nature, giving it back. So in a way, you know, we give it back, we give it all back when we die, right? So our bodies go back into the earth, you know. I don't really teach about rebirth or, you know, whatever happens with the mind, with the different patterns, because I don't know. It's only teachings that I can't understand because I haven't lived it. So I leave it in not knowing. And well, there's a lot in that not knowing. Great, big, vast. basket with no bottom. And but we eventually just give it all back, right? All our possessions, we can't, you know, the expression goes, you can't take it with you, right? So all our money, whatever we've tried to hold on to, build up, our reputation, out of our control, well, it always was, you know, but all of those things that we were trying to control, trying to accumulate, trying to build up, it just dissipates anyway. It just goes back into the earth, goes back into the void. And so relinquishment is that sense of, you know, spiritual teachers often say, die before you die. You know, die before you die is... Many teachers have said that. I think Muhammad said it. And certainly Ajahn Chah said it, and many teachers have said it. Die before you die. So die before you die means you know, live as if it's all already lost. There's a story about Ajahn Chah that he had a this favorite cup. He had this mug that he loved, and he used to say, "It's already broken." You know, like, so he wouldn't worry about it breaking because he said it's already broken. So a funny story for me is that. I told this story, and then a student, you know, who was moving away, wanted to give me, a thank you gift when they were leaving, and so she had this mug. She knew a potter, and she had this mug made, and she wrote. She asked him to write around the edge of the cup, "This mug is already broken." So then I found myself, you know, kind of cherishing that mug and being extra careful with it. This is so special. So, yeah, throwing it all back, giving it all back. So maybe we have to do that again and again, you know, just over and over, like just reminding ourselves that we don't really have things. It's hard to remember. Joseph told a story, Joseph Goldstein, when when I was near the beginning of my insight meditation practice, when I was going down there, and he told the story about when he was in India. And he had this little radio, and that he brought with him, and you know, he put it down somewhere, and whoops, it was gone. And he said, "I was really upset because it was kind of a lifeline for him. And he said, I guess I thought it belonged to me. And when I heard that, I didn't understand what he meant. I said, of course it belonged to you. And, yeah, but he had a deeper view. So, it's good to have a view. It's good to have a view of where we're going. It's good to have a map of the territory. The Zen saying goes, "Is the map is not the territory." So we learn to inhabit, become familiar with the territory in the unfolding of our practice. It's good to have a sense of how it unfolds, so that when something new unfolds, we realize that that there's a kind of a lawful or an orderly. It doesn't unfold always, as I said in another talk. It doesn't always unfold in succession, but there is an unfolding, a deepening, and. And what I want to emphasize is that in this, you know, when we stop grasping, when we stop chasing experience, when we come to a kind of a resting in openness, that we're not annihilated, that there's not when we let go of who we think we are, we discover who we truly are, which is a beingness, an isness that we are. It's not that we are this or we are that. There's simply a beingness, which is deeply connected to life, and which is and where in which there is a profound peace beyond understanding. So let's sit for a few minutes before we walk.